Well, good evening and a very warm welcome one and all to Dr. Rock's radio show here on peoplesinternetradio.com, where we are seeking and finding solutions. Well, I'm coming to you tonight from yet another office and yet another router. This one's likely to be a little bit busier than the rest because we've got a library on one side of us where people like to meet and do presentations, and on the other side of us there's a bit of a dormitory room where later on people will be trying to go to sleep. So it's possible that we might have to slip over to a bit of music, or maybe I might have to start talking a bit quieter later on in the show. But there's a bit of stuff to get through. In the meantime, me and Synchro are back for another 2-week stint at the fabulous old Chapel Farm. I'm sure some of you will remember the show that I did about this place a couple of weeks back. In the time since we've gone, obviously all the willing workers on organic farms have changed over, so we've got another 6 or 7 people here who weren't here last time. Last time it was nearly all ladies from South Korea and Spain and France. This time we've got nearly all men. We've got a lady from Germany, a couple of guys from Spain, another man from France, and one of the things I really like about it is that it really changes the atmosphere of the place. It makes it, although it's the same place and we're doing more or less the same things at this time of year as we were last time, there's a whole new set of people to meet. Last night we got to see the young lads from Spain doing a presentation on where they come from, where they live, what they do at home, about their pet dogs and rats and all that sort of stuff. And I particularly enjoyed, having not actually looked at Google Earth myself very much, I particularly enjoyed the freedom and ease with which they kind of zoomed in on the places where they lived and kind of drove us around the town, around the virtual versions of their town. So we saw some pretty astonishing things, really, including a town, I think it was in Catalonia, where the town has no gardens at all. All the gardens are outside the town, so everybody's got their kind of little, their house or whatever it is, their apartment in town, and then outside it goes green and they've got loads of dry stone walls and beautiful mature trees and a really astonishing and beautiful looking landscape. And later on in the show we'll be looking at dry stone walling in a bit more detail, because I've got a recorded conversation I had with Stuart Fry, who is a man who lives locally to us, who decided some time ago, in fact I think he's always believed, that it's best for us all to try and maintain some contact with the ancient ways of managing things, the old ways of dealing with the land and harvesting our trees, making our tools. In fact, he's got a fine collection of carts which he maintains himself, and as far as possible he goes to work on a horse and cart, and or just a horse. And when he's not doing that, he and his helpmeet, who's a lady who comes over from America called Whitney, they travel around there. They're two, you know, sizable, muscly people, and they travel around in this tiny little LPG Ford Fiesta. He hasn't flown for 10 years because he regards that as unsustainable, and he works hard at keeping knowledge and wealth in the local community, something which, as many of you will know, I believe pretty heavily in myself. As for Old Chapel Farm, Synchro is now not only just a shepherdess, she's been spending the last couple of days learning how to milk the cow, which is something that apparently a lot of people find quite difficult because it involves a lot of squeezing and pulling and leaning with your head into the cow's flank and all that kind of stuff. But after years and years being handy with a pair of secateurs, it's not making too much difference to her. It looks like she's taking to it like a duck to water. I haven't got any sheep to look after this time, although the yurt we've been staying in for the last 2 or 3 days has got a view over a field with some of the sheep that I was responsible for last time in it. It's good to see them again. Fabulous views. Different yurt from the one last time as well. This time I'm responsible for feeding the domestic dogs, looking after the best part of 3 dozen chickens. 3 dozen grown-up chickens, that is, because we've also got the 22 little chicklets that you saw photographs of last time. And they're now actually quite sizable birds already, and all really individual. We've been making cheese. I got to go and find an old well, because it had been lost over in a ditch somewhere on the far side of the farm, and we had to go and find that and dig it out and discover why it is that the water isn't flowing into the troughs that give the mouflon, the ancient sheep that we showed you a photo of last time, why they aren't getting the water in their trough. So it's it all feels very real to me, and it's tremendously exciting. It is. The weather's been really, really stunning for anywhere, I think, let alone for Wales. And we're getting our first cucumbers out of the polytunnel. We've been eating lots of raspberries. Somebody turned out the best part of 2 or 3 dozen jars of blackcurrant jam the other day. We ate a couple of those for breakfast this morning. You do get very hungry doing this sort of thing. I think we're probably going to be spending a lot more time at this place. Although we are now preparing as well for the next round of the festival season in a couple of weeks' time. We will be at the Green Gathering, helping to host the Avalon Rising Arena and catering for their crew, hopefully doing a couple of presentations, and also hopefully finding some interesting people to interview and maybe have live on the show. What, 2 weeks? 2 weeks tonight it'll be. I like to do a live show from the Green Gathering, see if we can't round up a few live guests. And we've actually managed to convince the Kitchen Posse. Jay and the Kitchen Posse will be turning up at the Green Gathering, and hopefully they'll be helping to host the show and coming on and having a chat, so you'll be able to hear their voices as well. Earlier in the week, we had one of the high points in the year for me. We were in between being here and coming back again. We went to stay at the Willow Theatre because we're busy developing a kitchen garden there, which is something else I hope to show you photos of. As I said last time, we seem to be having a tremendously successful time there. For some reason, we're not getting too much difficulty from all of the slugs and voles and mice that hang out in the place. And our vegetable crop there is coming on apace. Some of the more seasoned listeners will have noticed that you didn't get subjected to your normal Shakespeare tales from me, because this year I was away in at the Tribal Love Cooperative's Beltane gig, when I should have been on stage playing my usual part in our community play. But this last week we saw the regular yearly visit of the Factory Theatre Company to the Willow Theatre. They are, in my opinion, I've seen a lot of theatre. I know there's probably people out there who maybe never been to see any live theatre, and I think I can understand why. It is by and large incredibly expensive, and a lot of it fairly unconvincing or of minority interest. Shakespeare, of course, himself can be pretty difficult, assuming he is, of course, a he and not a them. But it's something that the Factory do a lot of, and they, this time round, they did a play called Pericles, which is, like many of Shakespeare's stories, a pretty crunchy kind of yarn. It, in the wrong hands, it would be completely unconvincing. But these guys spent only 3 days rehearsing it. I think they had the best part of 3 dozen people in it. And what they do is they turn up and they don't have any set, they don't have any props, and they don't have any costumes. So the kind of expensive things that other theatre groups use and concentrate on to try and create the illusion is completely not necessary to them. And they did that once again. They turned up after 3 days rehearsal and made a frankly incredible story, thoroughly, thoroughly entrancing. I think it was helped by the fact that the Willow Theatre itself attracted an audience of 60 or 70 people who, I think we knew every single one of them, and one way or the other, all of the people in that audience are involved in various community activities. We do a lot of stuff out here for which we don't get paid. And so a mixture of such a marvellous crew of people on the stage and a marvellous crew of people in the audience made for a great night out. As usual, the Factory, whenever they did need a prop, they either found it around the theatre or they got it from the audience. So there's a bit of a riddle that's given at the beginning of the play, and one of the actors nicked a bottle of beer from an individual in the audience, and as he was supping on the beer, it was as though each sup of the beer revealed a bit more of this horrendous riddle, which is basically to do with, when you have it away with your own daughter. This king was basically so in love with his own daughter that he was slaughtering anybody who wanted to come along and marry her. And it all ended up with a bit in Diana's temple, and they represented Diana and her bow with a guy standing at the back of the stage, a bloke playing, you know, standing in for Diana, and he had a coat hanger as her bow, and as the quiver he had this blue shiny handbag, both of which had been kind of grabbed from the audience one way or the other during the various shipwrecks. They were using hose pipes that they'd found around the place as ropes. All of this to show that that our minds do make what they will of the things that we're being shown. The factory's manifesto itself is pretty interesting. I'll stick a link for them into the chat box and during the next bit of music. It's likely to be a bit more music than usual this year, for this week, for one reason or another. One of their main thoughts is that theatre should be supported by an industry. It shouldn't really be the other way around, which is what's going on, it seems to me, at the moment. And that there's, at the moment, the plays that pull the biggest audiences have big budgets and big special effects and big sets and big star casts, and the factory espouses the idea, and I think show themselves when they're on stage, that there's no need for star casting and technical wizardry to inspire people if you've got an enthusiastic and competent crew doing what they're supposed to be doing on the stage, and that with imagination, innovation and ingenuity, a little bit of money can go a long way, which I think, you know, is true both of the factory and Old Chapel Farm, really, because the whole thing is not to do with making money. The factory are there to entertain the audience, to support each other, and to produce a show without any of the trappings of illusion that we're used to seeing on the telly and in the theatre and on the big screen. They also feel that, as do I, that theatre stands no chance of regaining its cultural importance unless it actually gets with the times and stops slavishly relying on and building on old models that have kind of come to us from the Victorian age and before. As I say, leading to big theatres and very, very expensive shows. Even in Mid Wales, really, it's not practical for us to go and see things in the local theatre because they're getting more and more expensive. We have to travel quite a long way to go and see them as well. And the establishment itself is also pretty hierarchical and formidable, really. It's very difficult for young people to get in there and kick against it. Something that I think the factory do really well. And they maintain that the best work is produced by people with a shared vision who are willing to push each other and test and support one another in what they call an open and passionate environment. Just the chance to work with such a team of people, I think, is really great. They seem to get bigger and better each time we see them. And this time around, as usual, they called on one or two members of the Willow Theatre Company to turn up on the stage with them. We got very little instruction. All we were told was that we were given a cue. When a given character spoke a given line, we were to kind of line ourselves up and we were to get on the stage and impress the lady, basically. I was one of those knights, enjoyed it a lot. And then once you're on the stage, they actually managed to direct you whilst you're there. So having done the impressing the lady bit, one of the ushers, as you might call him, another character in the play, said to me, he said, we're going to dance now. Get somebody from the audience. So there were five or six of us, I think, and we all had to grab somebody from the audience and make a waltz, effectively, on the stage. And all of that is just done ad hoc and looks really great. It's great fun to be part of, and I don't think I've ever seen an audience respond so enthusiastically to something on a stage, apart from perhaps maybe last time the factory came. I would recommend again that anybody who hasn't been to see live theatre, try to find something that you like the look of and go and give it a peer, because we know that we're living in something that is largely illusory, that there are experts involved in conducting and producing the illusion that is around us every minute of the day, in the adverts, in the billboards, in the newspapers, in the TV news, where they appear to be making it up and filming it on set quite a lot instead of actually going out there and getting real news. And I'm amazed time and time again by the way that a theatre company live and in front of you playing a play that was written several hundred years ago and, as I say, is a bit shaky in terms of its actual plot, can draw you in really quickly. You can see how easy it is to make an illusion that, works really well on our minds. And for me, it helps remind me of the wider illusion, if you like, the more expensive one, the one that it's so difficult to see through. In fact, the one that I guess every single one of the people listening to this show didn't know about. I think we all had this moment of awakening, didn't we, when a world that appeared to be normal and honest and properly paid for turned out to be more or less a complete sham, if not a complete sham. So there's a lot of things going on in the life of the Doctor at the moment. It's a very busy time. I'm still intending on keeping on with the show as things get more and more hectic around me. Hopefully we'll meet more and more people to talk to, but for the next couple of weeks or so it's going to be a little more difficult to pull together a whole 3 hours of stuff. I think we managed to scrape some interesting stuff together for tonight though. So I'm going to play another three tunes. As I said, I can hear some stuff going on behind me, so we'll play two or three tunes whilst that sorts itself out, and then we'll move on to the main business of tonight's show, which is a conversation I had out in the wilds of Mid Wales. I went to visit Stuart Fry on one of the sites he's working on, actually building old-styly new stock control things out of dry stone wall. He's not doing it because it's fashionable. He doesn't go and do it in people's gardens. He does it in places where there are animals that need to be contained. And one of the reasons he's doing it is because, like me and Synchro, he's really a bit sick and tired of seeing stock controlled by fences and barbed wire and things that are just bought rather than and then imposed on the countryside rather than becoming part of the countryside. Things that it takes one or two people and a machine to put in place instead of people coming and doing what is really effectively not only practical stuff but really gorgeous stuff to look at as well. And I've put together, because you all seem to enjoy the photos so much last time, I've put together half a dozen shots or so of the place that we were sitting in when we were doing the interview. In the meantime, we'll come up with that shortly, 10 minutes or so. In the meantime, here's Eye Monster and Daydream in Blue, because it does seem to me that this is all something of a daydream. I can scarcely believe it's happening. You can probably hear me smiling as I'm talking. I'm feeling remarkably chipper. I hope you're all feeling chipper too. Back in 10 minutes or so. Thanks to Chuck for reminding me that incest was the word that I was after that went missing from me there with regard to the Shakespeare. And that last track was Opaque playing Lack of Tact, which goes out to all those ancient Spartans that are currently being discussed in connection with eugenics in the chat box. Seems to have sparked off a bit of conversation there. I didn't know that that's how they ran their society, but I didn't know that the Greeks, I didn't know where the Greeks inherited it from, I guess. Before that, Eddie and the Hot Rods and Ignore Them, and then Eye Monster, Daydream in Blue. On the subject of eugenics, I was quite surprised when I discovered that the Darwins and the Huxleys have been intermarrying for several generations, somewhat successfully it would appear. And of course that means that the same people that brought us the theory of evolution also brought us Brave New World. Just an interesting coincidence, I'm sure. So the next thing I want to play, because it'll give me a bit of a breather, I'm looking forward to hearing it myself again actually, because it was a great chat, is an interview, a chat I had out in the landscape with Stuart Fry, who is a professional dry stone waller and a very charming man as well. As he refers to the landscape during the interview, I thought it'd be a good idea just to give you access to one or two photographs that you might want to have a quick look at. So I'll paste the link into the chat room, which I'm then going to have to read out for the people who don't have access to the chat room, unfortunately, because they're on my website. Oh, and the Wedgwood, says Mahatma, them too. What, same into the same group? God, there's just no end to this stuff, is there? The link to the pictures that I took of the place where Stuart and I were working, where Stuart was working, is now in the chat box at peoplesinternetradio.com. You can very easily record your presence here and come and join us in the chat room, and then you'll easily be able to see these links, which will save me a bit of time. You'll notice, those of you that can see it, that I no longer have a www in front of my links. That's because apparently my websites and stuff are now not on the World Wide Web, but somewhere slightly to the side. I don't know how these things work, but there you go. That's what my webmaster's done, and 10 out of 10 to him. In fact, I think they've always been set up like that. It's just that he enabled the World Wide Web links to, I don't know, because that's what people are going to put into their machines, I guess. So it's still got the https://... which I guess is us. I don't know, that's just something we've ended up with. But after that, internetradio.dr-rock.biz/download/stuart.fry.pdf, and Stuart is Stuart .fry.pdf. It does say the link is an untrusted site, but you can take it from me, you can trust it. It's you probably trust it better than the other ones, I think. I think that's one of the reasons why Mick does that. So it's the https://internetradio.dr-rock.biz/download/stuart.fry.pdf. I'm going to have to open it myself now so I can remember what photos are actually in it. You have to give me a moment whilst we kind of find out where on earth we put this thing. I think there we go. The first picture actually is connects Stuart with the Willow Theatre, because it's a bit of work that he did at the farm, at the organic farm where the Willow Theatre is sited. And it's a wall that was falling apart, and you can see that he's built this nice big round kind of towery thing at the end of it, which I particularly like. I've always loved dry stone walls. I wouldn't mind having a go at it myself sometime. The next picture shows the other side of the same wall, and that's another good thing about them, is they do tend to look very different on one side from the other. The third picture is the Doctor and Stuart, and Stuart standing next to one of his other walls. You see that he makes use of whatever kind of stones are around, because there's a lot of stone around that kind of place. That's why the dry stone walls, of course, became popular there. In places where there is no stone, they found other ways of doing things, and they would have done laid hedges, which would have been maintained to be stop-proof. You wouldn't have to have, like we get nowadays, a laid hedge with a stop-proof fence on the other side of it. The hedge itself would have done the job. The following picture is Whitney, who, whilst we were having our chat, was busy working away. The thing she's building there is going to be a sheepfold. It's going to be a place where the sheep get herded into to do various things to them, something that some of you will know I had some experience of myself a couple of weeks back here at Old Chapel Farm, when we had to round up our various sheep, get them into a place where we could check them out for the various awful diseases they get, and treat them for some of the things that we knew they had, mark them up accordingly. Whitney comes over from America to help Stuart. I think he spends quite a lot of time working on his own. And the next two shots are a view of from where Stuart and I were having our conversation. We were sitting in the lee of a big rock where we could rely on the wind to be stopped from, prevented from interfering with the voice recorder that I was using. And the first one is a view as you look left up this particular reservoir, and he refers at one point to the steepness of the valley and to the sessile oak forest that is on there, and you can see that in that photograph. These valleys are incredibly steep. They would have been very, very beautiful places before the Victorians came along and flooded them with water. It's actually part of a series of dams. I think there's three of them in all, so there's four reservoirs. You can also see, if you look at it, that because of the dry weather we've been having, the level in it is pretty low. If it continues to stay warm and sunny, we will see the water levels drop further until you can, in the end, see the villages that were in the bottoms of the valley where people used to live before it became necessary to pile up loads and loads of water in there. I think that Shelley had a big garden there, the poet, Shelley the poet, and you can actually see his house sometimes, and the and the remains of the garden walls. And all of that water, all of that work was done simply to get water to Birmingham. None of the water that was gathered as a result of this huge imposition on the landscape ended up being used by Wales. It all went to Birmingham, and still does, I believe. I think the Welsh might see a little, the Cymric people might see a bit of it, but I think that it all still basically goes to the English metropolis. The other thing is that there isn't a lot of Welsh spoken anymore in the area of Mid Wales, and I'm told that the villages that were in those valleys did have fairly large or substantial Welsh-speaking populations, so we might suspect, might we not, that they had other reasons for selecting those particular places. Of course, in those days, they were trying to get rid of the Welsh. They were using a knotted rope to beat it out of children. Anybody that was caught speaking Welsh in class would be prevented from speaking it. And now it's all gone flip side up, and now I think if you go to school in Wales, you are obliged to learn Welsh. There's two ways of doing it. A lot of schools have a Welsh stream where all of the education happens in Welsh, which I suspect is probably quite useful at bringing the language back. But if you go to school in Wales, then you have to learn the Welsh. Also, I think nowadays, if you want a job in any sort of government, or many of the arms of government that are funded by it one way or another, then if you can't speak Welsh, you have to at least make an undertaking to learn it. So it's interesting, isn't it, how one day something is completely illegal, and then the next day it's obligatory. It's a very, very funny way of running things. So hopefully you've had a chance to get those pictures. I'm now going to play the conversation that I had with Stuart, in which we talk about some of the old skills. He's a very knowledgeable guy. We talk about some of the old skills that we've lost, and we also talk about some of the completely bizarre and insane things the administration has done to try and make the countryside look nice, which is fundamentally what it's about, it seems to me. So here's the Doctor talking to Stuart Fry. Hope you enjoy it, guys and girls, folks.
You've got woodland, haven't you? Yeah. That's one of your passions, isn't it, trees and woodlands? Have you been hearing much about these tree diseases?
I talk to Ray Woods whenever I catch up with him, to get the update. Because ash is my big worry, because I use a lot of ash for my cart restorations and things, you know. Yeah, and I mean, his view is that 20 years there won't be an ash tree around.
I think that's probably the case, unfortunately.
You know, and I mean, not as drastic now in terms of the loss of the timber, because nobody bloody uses the stuff. But I mean, in terms of, well, we all know what will happen in terms of habitat, will we, until it goes? But what do you think, if that had happened in the 19th century, because, you know, everything was dependent on ash, oak was a subsidiary.
Yeah.
Because oak's got a few as well.
I know, there's oak.
I've been looking into it a bit.
Yeah, there's the oak problem, there's a problem, I don't know whether it is a problem in softwoods.
The larch and the pine, the Corsican pine.
I know. Well, I remember years ago, I used to go to France a lot, back in the 70s and 80s, you know, and I mean, they had a huge problem there then that had started towards the end of the 60s. They hadn't really spotted it, and it had, you know, these lovely avenues of plane trees, you know, the typical French. And that turned out to be a bug that had come in the Second World War in American army packing cases. And that had just got into them, and of course it had taken 20 years after the war, it was starting to, these things were suddenly breaking off, falling down, and
so our planes have got that now.
That's right. I know.
It's really sad.
I know.
It's really sad.
We have buggered the planet, really. I'm afraid.
We've buggered things up a bit, haven't we?
Yeah. There's no doubt about that. We can't, you know. And I'm afraid I've got to the point now where I think, well, I'll do my little bit, but I really think we've probably, you know, my granddaughter. I just think, well, God knows what sort of planet she's going to inhabit, like.
Yeah.
Because it is, you know, wherever you look in the world.
Yeah.
Climate is fucked, excuse my language. Water is, you know, gone. God knows what's happening in the oceans, because, you know, I watched a programme just before Whitney came over. It horrified me. It just happened to catch one of these, I don't even know what the programme was, and they were down in these deep trenches of the Pacific. you know, whatever it's called, is this huge sort of, like, much deeper than any of the highest mountain. You know?
Yeah.
And the stuff, anyway, they eventually got it, and it was just plastic, tiny, tiny little bits of plastic.
Yeah.
And the camera was just going through.
Yeah.
You know, you could see these fish just...
Yeah. Yeah, I was told the other day, we were talking with some recyclers at the Fire in the Mountain Festival, and they were telling me that some of the beaches are now kind of 30% plastic. So you can imagine that in the long run, you'll end up with a plastic beach with traces of gravel in it.
And all that in 100 years, really.
Yes, yes. And, you know, the people in charge, it's all very well banning the movement of ash once you've imported the disease. But we gather, when we were reading about the tree diseases, we were gathering that they're changing a lot of power stations over to burn wood chip. And they reckon we can only produce about 10% of the wood chip we need, so we're going to have to import it.
We're already importing it.
And of course, it's
going to come in.
No, it's they're a haven for pests, aren't they? Kind of
mouldering wood chip,
and presumably because they have like the ash dieback and stuff in Europe, quite a lot of the wood chips possibly.
Oh yeah,
ash.
Europe. I mean, I was looking at that. You were studying this thing on what's it called, Tree 51. It's one ash tree that survived in the Netherlands. They're trying to look at the genetics of it, you know, and it's just gone. In fact, I'll be interested to see now when I go over. Just gone right out to the Netherlands. Mm. Luxembourg, gone. Western Germany, gone.
Mm.
Nothing left, you know. I mean, I remember just about the elm was disappearing in England. You know, I was down in Sussex and Kent then. And if we lose ash, that would be the same effect on our landscape. But as you say, habitat-wise, you don't know, you know, no one has really studied where it sits within woodland ecology.
Mm. You know, but it is our most common tree, isn't it?
Yeah.
And I know that if the oak goes, there's hundreds of species that are specific to oaks. And some of them have lived, apparently, the creatures you get on the mature tree are the descendants of the ones that were kind of living on the sapling. So the scale of the thing I'm doing is... It's quite shocking, really.
Anyway, what do you want to talk to me about?
What I'd like to talk about is how the land used to be managed, because I gather you know a fair bit about the Lower Llanuthal Valley.
I know historically how it was managed. I don't know it from the point of view of doing it.
No, but what I'm after is a bit of chat as to how things used to be managed, how they're being managed now, and how you think we should go. You know.
Oh God, is there?
It's a topic, isn't
it?
Yeah, it's a topic.
Well, it's a rare chance to talk about somebody.
And what does it go out on?
It goes out on an internet radio station called peoplesinternetradio.com. But I'll send you notice of that, and then it'll go up as a podcast on my podcast page, so that people can listen to it. I'm never very sure how many. It's difficult to say how many people listen to the radio show, but certainly a fair few people are listening to the podcasts.
All right, okay.
And then it'd probably go out. I do a show on Friday as well on a station called Scottish No Borders Radio, which goes out on Scottish sovereigns on the land.
I spent the summer before last up in 2 summers ago. Now I finally got up into the Highlands in Orkney.
Yeah,
and I just wandered around the old crofters and. You know, because I've always been interested in the demise of the crofter, but also in the way that the crofters... Because what fascinated me was how, in isolation, really, farming systems evolved. So if you look at the environment, the geomorphology, say, but soil types, climate, all right, Scotland is... It, within Britain is different to this part, but globally it's not, you know, we're all within that, you know, North European sort of climate. But when you look at the way the farming evolved... Like the Yorkshire, for instance, the classic Yorkshire Dale with the barns in the fields. So there, instead of doing what we did here, which was to take the cows in, have them in all winter, you know, and take the feed to them, they thought, no, bugger this, we'll put the barn in the field, we'll put the cows there, and the hay from the field feeds those cows. And then the guy would spend all morning walking around with his can on his back, milking perhaps 2 or 3 cows in each barn.
Yeah.
And then you look at the crofting system, you know, and you think, well, how were those systems... evolving to achieve the same end, and yet they evolved in totally different ways.
Yeah.
You know, because, I mean, rainfall-wise, Yorkshire is not much difference to here. I think, why did you go for that? And
it is interesting, isn't it?
The whole way that, whether you built walls or whether you planted hedges, which was basically dictated by environment and geography. I mean, if you had loads of stone, well, you needed to clear your fields, which is why you've got stone walls low in the Yorkshire Dales and the Derbyshire Peaks and so on. Whereas here in Wales, you don't get them really below 800 feet because you could grow hedges there.
Yes, yeah.
And, of course, the higher you go, shallower the soil, more stone, so. And how all that then affects what we now think of as traditional landscape, you know. I mean, that's the big question, I think,
yeah.
Is this absolute obsession that the conservation world and the agri-environment people got with traditional farming methods. Well, what the hell is traditional?
Yes.
You know, to an Iron Age person, what they were doing in the agricultural revolution wasn't traditional. Mm. What the agricultural revolution did to people when the Acts of Union made Wales part of England, that wasn't, you know. So why do we choose this snapshot of history and say, right, that's what we want the countryside to look like?
Yeah.
And it seems to me it's a middle-class, educated English view of you know, a constable countryside, really.
Yes, yes. I mean, I know that when we look out over it with the Wildlife Trust and things, they seem to be happy with what they're doing, but I see a place that's more or less, I mean, looking here, what we see is grass, a few sheep, and monocrop trees there. Which doesn't strike me as being a very inventive way of using the place.
I mean, in the macro scene, really, I think we've got to look at the educational system. And you can look at it in terms of local government planning, right? To become a planning officer, a successful planning officer who sits in County Hall in Llandrindod and dictates what goes on in this landscape, 99% of the time, A, you won't be Welsh. You'll have been brought up in a very well-off middle-class English background, had a good education, gone to a university, probably vote Tory.
Yeah.
And then you come and you see it in the National Park, Bracken Beagles National Park. Classic. They come in with these ideas that have been formed through their own childhood, their own wealth. You know, they've never suffered hill farming poverty. Mm. They've never been here in the winter.
Never.
And it's the same within... certainly within CCW, you know, I mean, there was an element of Welsh. The archaeological trusts, you know, they're peopled by English middle-class graduates who really don't know bugger all about Welsh history.
Yeah.
And that, of course, you get to the peak then, you become the director or policymaker, and what's formed your opinion is your life track.
Yeah.
You ain't going to get a little kid from this farm is going to end up head of Rydon Wildlife Trust.
Which means, surely, that we're not learning anything from our farming experience.
No, we're not. And you see, we talk about the them and us gap wind. The them and us in terms of, it seems to me, the countryside, is the farming community and the so-called, you know, policymakers and conservationists, agri-environmentalists and so on, who form policy.
Yeah.
I mean, at the moment, I only put it on my blog last night, I mean, there is war between the minister and upland farmers. Mm. You know, absolute. The whole Glastier thing is a nightmare. You know, it's just ineptitude.
What's that specifically?
Well, the Glastier is, whilst it's not strictly an agri-environment scheme, it's the new scheme available to all farms to get grants. It's primarily a part of the UK government's hope to meet their air and water quality. Mm. So it's really about cleaning up nitrates.
Yeah,
you know, making water cleaner and air cleaner. But within it, there is an element of the continuation of Tyrconnell and Tyrgovel, the agri-environment schemes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And particularly in the advanced scheme, which is what's paying for this forward, there's the old capital works that pays to, you know, lay the hedges, fence it off, etc.
Yeah.
But the administration of it is hopeless. And what it's doing, I mean, like at the moment now, the job we should be on the Rogo, we've had to come away from because it started on the 1st of January. It's an £8,000 job. Started on the 1st of January. It's going to take me most of the year to do it. The contract wasn't eventually sent out until the end of April. So already the farmer's 4 months in.
Mm-hmm.
Trying to get money flowing. No, the claim forms still haven't come.
Mm-hmm.
He's already spent £28,000 on the work. He's up to his overdraft limit.
Yeah.
What's coinciding with all that, of course, is the economic problem. Banks will now not lend against the value of the farm.
Mm-hmm.
They will only lend against the profit and loss account.
Really?
Yeah. Well, at the moment in Wales...
So your farm no longer counts as capital?
No. So to get a bank overdraft now, you've got to show your profit and loss. They can't show anything at the moment because the minister hasn't decided how much the upland subsidy is going to be. So yeah. No farmer, as he sits, he doesn't know what he's going to get for his product this year. No other business is in that, you know, does that. He doesn't know what his lambs are going to make, good or bad, and he doesn't know what subsidies he's going to get. So going to the bank and saying, can I extend my overdraft? Mm. The bank's just saying, no chance, pal.
So what is the project on the Rogo?
Well, rebuilding a massive enclosure.
Mm-hmm.
But we've had to confront it, because I said, look, you know, I know you've got a problem. He said, no, I can't pay you. The bank, he's up to his limit with the bank. Mm. So we've had to go off and do little jobs, you know.
Yeah.
That means I'm not paying, like I've got bills now I haven't paid. The person I owe money to is not paying their bills. And before you know it, the whole rural economy, it's like when a foot and mouth came. You know, Labour just never realised that we were in an integrated economic system in the in the rural areas.
Mm.
So you suddenly stopped the flow to farming.
And everything stops.
Everything stops.
Yeah. And all as a result of decisions made by people who are probably not fit to turn our compost heap.
And what is frustrating is when you actually can get to someone, oh, right, I'll do it now. The times I've had that on payments. Oh, you're waiting a few minutes. Oh, I'll do it now. Bing. Yeah.
That easy.
How long would I have waited if I hadn't got through?
Why didn't you press the button without turning up?
Fortunately, most, like with CCW, when I was working for the old schemes and the National Park, I knew the people in the end, and I'd ring and say, right, there's an invoice for me. Will you? Yeah, right, bing.
Mm-hmm.
And I suspect what's happening at the moment, I mean, I've got it, the Commons, do you know the Commons have gone into a glass tier programme. So they're controlling grazing on the Common, and they're paying the farmers good money to hopefully keep the Commons in good health. Yeah. Same with thing. Contracts have not been issued. I've got sheep falls to repair down the Western Brecon Beacons. It's supposed to be in. Well, the contract again was supposed to start the 1st of January. They haven't even arrived yet.
Mm. And are there any penalties for these managers failing to manage?
No, but there's penalties for the farmer if he doesn't do it on time.
Well, that's what I was thinking, because you're kind of forced, aren't you, to do
like
things.
If I don't finish that Rogo wall by the end of this year, he'll get penalised.
Mm. Even though he hasn't got his money. Or actually anything he needs to do the job. So these people are... Because we have had a succession of these land management schemes, haven't we?
Yeah, and they've all had teething problems. But now, well, really, since the Welsh Assembly government came in, I have to be honest, in the old days of CCW running it, I mean, right, there were clashes because you were then into very idealistic conservation type...
Mm.
You know, like the purist, almost the Wildlife Trust type.
They don't seem to go for development. I mean, the landscape is changing.
Yeah, and they don't want that. They want to freeze it, you see.
Yeah, and I mean, again, there's not a lot of point to that. I mean, because we had the oak change, didn't we? Kind of 100 or so years ago,
right.
So that oaks are no longer seeding into our own ancient woodland. So
we've had all sorts of changes.
How can you possibly conserve something on that basis?
I mean. You know, people think, oh yeah, Wales sheep. You know, sheep were irrelevant up in the Zeppelins, really, until the middle of the 19th century. Mm-hmm. All right, they say, oh, yeah, well, the Cistercians had 5,000 sheep. 5,000 sheep on this mountain, well, you wouldn't have bloody seen them.
No.
You know, nothing.
Because they were pretty major, but we didn't have so many of them.
That's the thing.
Because they have
farms,
been...
Farms had, you know, I mean, they were not a product for farms. Cattle, were, you know, is what they made their money on. Sheep they just kept for their own milk, you know, and for their wool. I mean, these areas weren't producing good wool. They wasn't for the Elizabethan wool market. That was out of Pembrokeshire, out of the Severn Valley and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Up here, you know, sheep were irrelevant.
Do we know when the sheep arrived?
No, that's a very interesting thing. I mean, they were clearly here long before the Romans ever got here, you know, because they were an integral part of Iron Age farming. You know, they find the skulls and so on. So I guess they came with the population drift up from the Mediterranean, you know, up through Germany, Gaul, and across.
Yeah.
And maybe when the land bridge was there. Because in ecological terms, the land bridge isn't that long ago. But it is interesting, the sheep, when you look at all the different breeds.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, we were staying at a farm a couple of weeks back that's got it's got a small flock of soays.
Yeah.
Which
I've just been talking to Sorcher about those.
Yeah,
I mean, you look at those, where the hell did they evolve from?
Yeah.
You know, they've got none of the instinct of other sheep that to herd. They want to run in all directions.
They do, quite.
They look more like bloody, I don't know what, dwarf goats than anything else.
Yeah, they do. Yeah,
you know,
and they are much less cooperative. Although, once they've got to know you for a few days, then they will come to you.
But, I mean, you couldn't run 500 of them on these mountains. You'd never catch the bloody things.
No.
They only catch them because they've got the coast. They can't go into the sea. Anyway, come on, let's get going. It'll be dark.
Oh, well, we are.
Oh, are we recording?
Yeah, we are, yes.
Oh, I didn't realise.
Yeah,
all right,
yeah.
Okay.
I set it going because I can never
sorry,
tell.
Oh, sorry, well, I wasn't following the theme.
Yeah, no, you're all right. It's because I like its sound. It's just like a conversation,
oh, right,
really.
Well, it is, yeah, yeah. So in terms of how the land was managed and where we are at now, well, I think we're at a stage where I don't know whether the pendulum's ever going to swing back to those who profess to want to preserve, conserve, whatever you want to call it, you know, the conservation, environmental sort of side of it, will ever come to meet the farming community, even halfway. There seems to be a divergence, whereas I did think 10 years ago there was a convergence, you know. I actually think, because I do a lot of work, obviously, with farmers, there is more willingness and enjoyment, really, in understanding what they've got and looking after the land than they're given credit for.
Yes.
I mean, when I started walling 20 years ago under the first TIRCUM and the first agri-environment scheme in Wales, most of my customers really weren't that interested. Mm. In fact, the first five, I think, were members of the farming unions and had basically thought, well, we better show willing here. Mm. But gradually, as the things, you know, began to change, I mean, I've been doing a job for a guy last weekend who was my very first customer. And he was a typical Upland Hill farmer, tight fist, watched every penny.
Didn't sell land.
No, you know, accrued, didn't really care about hedgerows or birds, didn't know what the fuss was about. Walls, he lived with these walls, you know, he took over from his father, the walls had always been on the floor. Didn't really worry if they were up or not. But now he actually rings me up and pays me to build him walls.
Yeah.
And he was saying to me, he was showing out, he said, look at those hedges over there now. He said, they're marvellous. Do you remember what they were like? I said, yeah, there wasn't a hedge there. He said, there wasn't a hedge there. And look at it now. Mm. Fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, and he will actually say, TIRCUM was the best thing that happened to this farmer.
So the so at least the early agri-environment schemes were helpful in A, in restoring the landscape a bit, and B, in actually drawing the attention of the farmers.
Yes, yes, there were some twee ideas. I mean, for instance, as it happened, I sat on one of the committees that in the previous life that looked at putting the thing together, you know. And there were twee ideas, like ponds, everyone. Because you could drive around and you could see who was in the scheme, because everyone would suddenly have a pond, and wooden gates.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I can remember, I won't mention his name on tape, but I can remember him sitting there saying, well, wooden gates, that's the tradition of the countryside. And also, in fairness, there was the thought that that would promote use of woodland. We'd use, you know, Welsh oak or Welsh ash to make wooden gates. Yeah. But, of course, the reality was we never did. We used softwood imported from wherever.
Yeah.
And suddenly, the other thing that they missed was proportion. Now, I happen to, sort of part of my background was art, and, you know, there is this, the perfect form that we want, the human eye wants to see is 2x1.
Yeah.
That's why I love Land Rovers. Mm-hmm. They're twice as long as they are high.
Yeah.
And the wooden gate, the 8-foot, 5-bar wooden gate is 8-foot by 4-foot.
Yeah.
Well, of course, nowadays that's no good to man or beast. The minimum they want is 10 foot. Most of them want 12 foot.
Because of the tractors.
Because of everything.
And the trailers.
Well, straight away, you've lost the aesthetic of the gate, but also you've lost the mechanics of the gate, because it's too damned heavy to hang. Yeah. Well, within 2 or 3 years of these wooden gates being put up, there wasn't one of them working. They're all on the floor, tied up with baler twine.
Mm-hmm.
After 10 years, when the farms came to the end of their schemes, and I mean, I had farms who perhaps had 20, 25 wooden gates, the inspectors would come out and do a final assessment, and of course, if the gates weren't any good, they had the money taken back off them.
Really?
Yeah. Or their hedgerows, you see. Or plant your hedgerows. Double fence, plant the hedge.
Mm-hmm.
Well, of course, farmers don't do gardening these days, so planting a hedge is like looking after a garden. You can't just stick things in the ground, heal them in, and expect nature
to
take
it.
Especially if you've double fenced, because the competing grass will just kill off the young.
Yeah.
You know. Mm-hmm. Plus, we were buying in hedging stock then from Poland and God knows where, so that, you know, local provenance didn't exist.
And again, there's no need for that.
No, in 1990, you know, nobody, it was only the purists who really understood, you know. So you'd come at the end of a 10-year period and the inspector would come and say, well, where's the hedge? Oh, well, it's...
So he got the grant for planting it, but without any maintenance or...
There you go, you see.
Yeah.
I mean...
And then they come and take your money back off you.
Take your money back then, you see. Which, you know, then of course got people's backs up, and I'm not going to do that, you know, and the whole wooden gate. I mean, you know, those schemes have ended, so wooden gates have gone now. They were back to metal gates. Mm.
And what we're saying is that had they been built out of, especially if they'd been built out of oak and been built to a known standard, then they'd have lasted 50 years.
You know, you look at the old railway gates. Yeah. You go on an old railway guard and wear the old gate, you know, they're good as new. They're still hanging.
Yeah.
But
see, this is something that I notice, is that there is apparently an intent to improve, say, the state of the gates. And so there's then a plan and financing and all of that to do it. And almost inevitably, it seems to me, that what happens is the death of the proper gate.
Yes, that's right.
And we seem consistently to achieve the opposite of what we're apparently setting out to do.
Well, what the trouble is, going back to this, you know, these middle-class notions, that was someone who had this twee idea of the, you know, without practicalities, 1,200 foot up on the Brecon Beacons or on the Cambria Mountains, with 27 inches of rainfall, a softwood gate is not going to last.
No.
And apart from anything else, who the hell's going to see it?
Mm. Yeah.
You know, they wouldn't allow it around the farmyard where people might have seen it.
Yeah.
The following scheme took over, yes, they would allow wooden gates around the farmyard and they would do up the old buildings.
Oh, so they're specifically telling you where you can where put you these gates as well.
So that was somebody's idea of what the countryside should look like.
Right.
And the pond. You know, and of course, you can't just go and stick a pond. People didn't understand.
It needs to flow of water.
Oh, well, it's all choked up. My pond's all choked up. Or it's dried up. Or it's...
Yeah,
well, you know, ponds, just old medieval ponds, you know, the watermen knew what they were doing when they built it.
Mm.
And a lot of what people call dew ponds, farm ponds, were meant to dry up. You know, they're supposed to dry up because that kills all the weed.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But they missed all that, you see. So these ponds were put in and a lot of them failed. I mean, a lot of the machine drivers who were hauled in to do the ponds, I mean, they were great on motorways and bypasses, but they weren't really that very good on understanding how ponds worked and so on. I mean, some of them were super. I could not believe the levels they would get from sitting in the cab. And when it filled, it was absolutely to the top all round. Like.
Yeah.
But, of course, the whole structure of the pond and the ecology of the pond was artificial.
And there's only some places where ponds can go anyway.
Absolutely. Yeah, yeah. But that was somebody's ideas.
Yeah. Because again, that sounds like a good idea, because we know we used to have ponds in every village, ponds everywhere, and we know that that's another...
But I mean, if you look at, you see, I forever say to people, look, it's Pendennoll is a classic example, right? That duck pond was never a duck pond. It's a cart horse wash. Every farm that had arable land needed somewhere to wash the legs of the cart horse. So most ponds on the edge of farmyards were never full all year round. They were only blocked during the ploughing season.
Right.
So, you know, autumn or spring.
Mm-hmm.
So that after they'd ploughed, they could walk them in, wash their legs off, and then they'd let it flow through. So if you think of Pendennoll Pond, it's on a stream.
Yeah.
Basically, you block the stream.
Yeah.
So it wasn't meant to ever hold water. And I don't know how much lime I put in the walls trying to... And I keep saying, look, you know, it isn't meant. The geese, the muck, it silts up.
Yeah.
They would let it wash through in the winter. You'd never see a pond shut off in the winter.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, you get people who want a different thing. They want ducks, which are the worst thing to have on a pond. Geese even worse, if you want wildlife.
Yeah, because they eat everything,
absolutely,
don't they? And they shit a lot too.
Yeah. Mm. And you can't have, you know, trout. Well, every farmer I know that put a pond in wanted trout. But, of course, you know, they would just eat any wildlife that's in there.
Yeah.
Especially rainbow. Yeah.
So even the ponds we were going to get weren't actually going to do what I'd imagine they were there for, which is to provide a kind of...
I mean, some of them have worked. I could show you a couple that have worked fantastically, but by accident.
Yes.
And primarily because the farmer wasn't bothered about it. He just left it to its own, you know, and it happened to be in a good place.
And again, nobody learnt from that experience.
No, well, that was the other big problem. The whole scheme was based on theoretical assumptions. One of the classics was hay meadow reversion. So the officers, particularly the botanic-minded officers of CCW, would come out and say, let's say this field where we are, this would have been a traditional hay meadow. Let's take it back to a traditional hay meadow. You can't put any fertiliser on it. You can't cut it till the 15th of July.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, great, okay. Well, there were two problems with that. Firstly, the 15th of July, at the moment we got the 19th of July, the 19th of July in the Vale of Glamorgan is far too late to be cutting hay. This year, the 19th of July up here is far too late. Where you've been this morning, that hay will have gone over before he cuts it.
Yeah.
You know, you can't have a prescriptive date throughout Wales.
Because I guess
1,400 foot in the Cambrian Mountains, yeah. It might be the middle of August, so the 19th of July is not a problem. Mm. But if you're in the Vale,
yeah.
So that was one problem. The second problem, which they totally, you know, didn't understand, I remember a young farmer in his 40s saying to me, I don't know hay. I've never done hay. I've only ever done silage. So I wouldn't know when a hay field is ready and when it isn't.
Mm.
And I remember saying to the chief officer in Llandeilo, look, this is a problem. Why don't you use mentors? Get old farmers who are still alive, who remember hay, to become mentors to these people you're trying to get to go into hay. Apart from anything else, they didn't have the damn machinery for making hay.
Mm.
You know, they only had silage machinery.
Yeah.
That's why, if you look around the countryside, you'll see, obviously, still a lot of silage, but you'll see a lot of haylage, because they can round bale with the same baler that they're using for silage.
Yeah.
They can, you know.
Yeah.
Nobody, I mean, actually, where we're sitting and looking, there's a small baler, which is nice to see.
Yes.
But, you know, nobody wants to manhandle bales.
Not many of them are around now, is there?
The notion of traditional farming and going back, A, it forgets the fact we've got to feed, like, five times as many people,
mm.
but also it forgets the evolution of machinery. It forgets the fact that, you know, we now need bigger gateways. We now trash hedges with machines instead of by hand,
mm.
and they massacre the hedges. I mean, I made the point of my talk that they're not, you know, that is the biggest crime.
I agree.
It's the biggest crime in the countryside, you know, these hedges. And then, you know, so we've got a problem with COVIDs, we're losing our field birds, RSPB are forever saying, oh, we're losing our songbirds, we're losing our field birds. But get rid of the COVIDs then.
Well, or grow hedges that the COVIDs can't actually get the bait, get the eggs, right. get the eggs and the baby.
I mean, there is within the scheme now, hedgerow management, which doesn't allow cutting.
Mm.
You have to be cutting a three-year cycle.
But I've noticed that what happens there, or what I've seen happen in at least a couple of places, is that it's cut to a certain extent, then it's let grow.
Yeah, well,
and
that's
then
because
they go along and they flail it exactly to the same
place.
Well,
that's because in the prescription, you've got two choices. You can keep your hedge to 1.5 metres wide, 1.5 metres high, and there's a low payment, or you can let it go to 1.8 metres or beyond, and you can only cut the sides every 3 years, and then you've got to let it go to height. So that's why you'll suddenly see that.
Okay.
Once it gets to 1.8 metres, they'll cut it off.
Right.
And when you ask farmers why that is, some of them might say, oh, well, it's light in the field, you know, it's stopping growth. The majority that I've ever spoken to say, oh, it looks untidy.
Mm.
And the ones who profess that loudest are usually standing in the farmyard. That is the worst bunch of scrap and mess that you've ever seen.
Yeah.
There's this notion of tidy countryside.
Yeah.
I mean, I remember when I first got involved with Coed Cymru years ago, you know, habitat piles. Every fallen bit of tree was gathered together into habitat piles. Well, now, thank goodness, we now say, no, leave it, you know, leave it where nature is.
Mm.
People still, oh, it's untidy. You know, why do we bring tidiness? The countryside isn't tidy.
No.
You know, you look at that woodland over there. It hasn't been cut to a perfect flat top. We are obsessed with, really what we are doing, and again, I think this is a part of education, part of where you come from, how you see things. We are bringing an urban ideal into the rural. We are bringing urban ideas, and you can see it in houses and planning. And you know, you look at Bungalow City, you know, the ribbon development. You know, I mean, Powys, well, certainly Radnorshire used to be one of the worst counties, Ceredigion behind us, you know, for planning permissions. And they would fight and fight and fight to not allow planning. But once they'd lost that battle, they didn't seem to care what the people put up.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
When really, to me, it should have been the other way around. You know, be a bit lax on where you allow people to put, but dictate what they put there to keep the character.
Yes, yeah.
I mean, so what's nicer than Eland Village?
It is amazing,
right?
Isn't
now,
it?
When it was built, it was probably an eyesore to the locals.
Yeah.
But this, you know, I know it's arts and crafts, there's pride in it. You know, when you look at the bungalows that you drive through on the way down to Cwmtaidder or any Welsh village, that ribbon development that goes out.
And also, I mean, what they are building, they seem to have carte blanche from my point of view, because some of the things that are built by farms are really huge and really ugly.
Yeah.
Loads and loads of concrete, loads of iron, no traditional skin.
Well, it's
in
industrial,
that,
isn't it?
It is industrial.
You know, what you're looking at an industrial estate on a farm now.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the sad thing with that is where the buildings have consumed the old the old traditional, you know, barns and cow
houses. You still see them, don't you? Beautiful brick-built barns.
Well, and stone and stone, the whole lot,
with
you know.
Fancy work and...
Yeah.
So many of those also are now lying empty and derelict. Presumably, I don't know what they're waiting for, but...
Well, you see, what's happened there is the... I guess the big thrust towards barn conversions, you know, that went on, what, certainly 80s, 90s and so on, when prices were high. That, I think, you know, what I call the white settlers coming in, it converted those and given them a life. Now, I guess I'm ambivalent now. I didn't like it at first. I thought, oh, that's a shame that you're, you know. But I saw people saying, yeah, but otherwise they're going to fall down.
Mm.
Well, I think it was a shame that we couldn't have paid people. Now, under this current scheme, and indeed under Tregoval, they would grant aid, only 50%, but they would grant aid you to maintain old buildings, but they had to stay within agricultural use.
Yeah.
And what's happening now, if you look in the local papers and you look at barns that's for sale, you'll usually see... for industrial or tourist use, you know, not for residential.
They're really encouraging anything that's to do with tourism and things.
But there's a limit to that, isn't there?
Well, yes, quite a marked limit, especially if your countryside's going to pot.
Quite. I mean, look at this road. I've been working on here. I don't know. I haven't counted, but there's certainly, I would say, a car every 2 minutes.
Really?
Yeah.
Yeah, and this is a road that simply goes round the dams, isn't it? It goes, comes up one side and goes down the other
and
side.
And I know the Trust want to encourage more and more tourism. Well, how sustainable is that?
We were a bit surprised when we were looking at one or two prospects for maybe putting up little wooden cabins and stuff. We were very surprised to find the County Council was all in favour of that if they were near the Wye Valley Walk or something like that.
That's right.
It seems to me that they're happy to give permission for things that encourage tourism. Whereas they're making it harder and harder for people to farm the land.
Yeah.
So did we ever have, sort of us more or less self-sustainable farms here?
Yes, I think we did. You see, I mean, whether we could ever go back to that. I think we could go back to a more local, integrated, cooperative, or whatever word you want to use, system. And certainly we would have had that. And, of course, the great engine for that were the estates. Because really, although it was some would say a hierarchical, you know, maybe dictatorial, whatever, it was a community that had a common purpose. And all right, some of the landlords weren't very nice.
Mm.
But generally speaking, certainly through the age of improvement, you know, from the end of the 18th century through the 19th, you know, I think the landscape we now have, that's when that was really generated, you know, and there was care. It was only care in the sense of if you didn't work with nature, you didn't get a good product.
Yeah.
Right? Now, that's the big change. And, of course, everyone knows that science really has been the cure and the problem, whether you're looking at food or medicine or certainly in farming and the management of the land. Post-Second World War, we haven't got to worry about nature. We can overcome it.
Mm.
And now, of course, we are paying the price.
Trying to dominate it rather than...
Yeah, and we killed everything. You know, DDT killed everything. Mm. But, yes, I mean, these areas... They would have been self-sufficient. They would have sold, what, 2-3 cows?
Mm-hmm.
They would have grown all their own vegetables. You can show me a farm now that has a vegetable garden.
That was going to be one of my questions, was did we ever grow crops here? Because you just don't see them.
Well,
so what was grown in Wales?
Oats. What have you got to realise? I mean, my grandmother used to boast she never tasted white bread until she was in her late 20s, which would have been about the 1930s, I suppose.
Mm.
Oats. If you look at what people were eating in Wales, it's quite amazing. You know, to sustain a man and a woman through the winter, the man needed about 16 pounds of oats a day.
And the woman day? 16 pounds of oats a day?
And the woman about between 12 and 14 pounds, right, a day. So these big wooden coffers, right, that you see in the antique shops that fetch huge money, that's what they were for.
Mm.
They would store your oats.
And,
you would have pottage, you would have oat cakes, you'd have... bread, you know, a little bit of bacon, but so you had to grow that amount, that's without the kids and the animals. And similarly, believe it or not, in Ireland, that's why the potato famines were so horrendous, you needed the same amount of potatoes. A man needed about 16 pounds a day, that's a stone in old money, and a woman
load
about
of, a load of weight of oats and potatoes. That.
So, of course, with the failure of, you know, the blight in Ireland, that's
of course, we know now that during the Irish potato famine, they were actually exporting a whole shedload of food.
Yes, they were a net exporter of meat.
They were.
Yeah, absolutely incredible. Mm. But, yeah, so, I mean, barley would have been grown. Barley would have been grown quite high, you know, only small amounts. So it could be done. But again, then, you know, what you've lost is, A, you've lost labour, which is ironic because we're in a mass period of unemployment. Mm. So like we were talking about our hedges, why haven't we go back to a system whereby instead of the county council paying for massive tractors to come and trash the hedges, I've never done the economics of it, but pay a man. You know, pay the old lengthsman who used to look after a couple of miles of road and did the whole lot.
Yeah, and had the right to harvest stuff that was coming off the hedge as well.
You know, why don't? Oh well, you know, the absurdity now. I saw it the other day. I thought, you know, talk about the lunatics running the asylum. There was a huge pickup, Powys County Council pickup, with massive lights flashing on the back, like something you'd see on the M25. Two guys sitting in it. Then there's a tractor mowing, and then there's another pickup in front with another two guys with flashing lights. So acting as guardians, because of health and safety now.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I don't know how many tractor drivers have been killed or how many cars he's killed, but I surely can't be that many that they tie up. And the cutting of the roadside, the amount of fumes of diesel, you know, go back to labour-intensive. My job, this terrific amount of work that could be done. You're better off paying people to do something valuable, healthy. Now, all right, whether you could get young people who want to do walling, that's another matter. But then again, that's part of it, you know, to do with education,
isn't it? Yeah.
And the family. But, I mean, there's a huge amount of work that would benefit the countryside.
Mm.
And especially with tourism. I mean, you know, we're like on display here. We're working here on the side of the road. Certainly, I would say 1 in 3 cars that pass stop.
Mm.
You know, when you get the questions of what you're doing and why you're doing that, and, you know, get questions you can't answer, like, what are you doing? Well, I don't want to be rude, you know. I had a classic the other day up on the Rogo. This woman stopped and they were looking, and she said, "Is that a real wall?" I said,
or are you just up here Walt Disney style?
You know, so there's so much work that could be done, and crop growing would be the same, you see. But, of course, I don't know how we leap now from a, you know, we've lost, for instance, is there a farmer alive who could still sharpen a scythe?
Mm.
You know?
Yeah, I don't know whether there's farmers that can sharpen scythes. There are still people around.
Yes, there are. I've been to Scythe Fest down in Somerset. There's a whole, but do you know what I mean? It's that technique, you see. And would we ever go back to a time when we didn't use machinery? I don't know.
Even that is really heavy and damaging on the land.
Yeah, it is.
You know, even when we're growing veg, we try quite hard not to walk on the soil that we're growing on. And these tractors are massive.
Yeah.
And they drive them on the fields when they're wet as well. There was a story about Cuba. I mean, it evidently is possible to do this, because apparently when the Iron Curtain came down and Cuba lost all of its diesel, and America was still had an embargo on anything. Apparently what happened there was all their tractors got converted to buses. They suddenly started breeding oxen and training people to run oxen on the land. All manner of little bits of Havana suddenly started growing veg instead of being wasteland. And apparently the nation lost on average a stone and a half in weight.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's... that really cheered me up, that it was called The Power of Community.
Yeah.
So it's not impossible to imagine it
happening. No. And that's what we have to do, you see. I can't believe that the world can go on with a global economy. It makes no sense to me.
No.
You know, there's all the talk about, you know, eat seasonal fruit and we're importing. But how, you know, who's going to do it? How am I going to stop using my car?
Mm.
But I would if, you know, if there was a concerted effort. I was fortunate when I started walling. All my work was within 5 miles of home. So, I mean, I should have got a horse. You know, I didn't. I should have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Instead of driving a damn Land Rover every day, I should have got a horse and cart.
Yeah.
Because God knows I've got enough carts at home. And then I was very involved with a thing called Letts. Have you ever come across Letts?
Yes,
you know, the local exchange trading system.
Yeah.
Why we haven't, you know, got to grips with that, I cannot understand.
Mm.
You know, because that
particularly in an area like this, particularly in a vibrant little community like Rheda, you know, we should be doing that.
Yeah.
You know, I should be able to go to the garage and pay him in bobbins or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And I've earned that from doing the wall.
Yeah.
You know, Brian should be paying me in that thing's currency that I can go into Rheda and I can have a tyre or I can have a meal in the pub or whatever.
Yeah. And that way, you're quite a lot of the tax burden gets removed. Well,
that's right, and that's
it?
Why, of course, they haven't been allowed to grow. Really. I mean, credit unions only sort of came after a bit. I was heavily involved in starting those in Wales, and you know, luckily, the legislation that was introduced there by a Tory government was really not spotted. They didn't quite realise what they were doing. But I mean, they haven't taken off to the extent that they are in Ireland or America or France. Yeah. But you know, that's the sort of thing you'd need to do. Food, local food is you've got to start with local food and you've got to start with local farmers. But when subsidy is like it is, when farmers are having to jump through so many hoops, when you've got policy makers who are following some agenda that we don't understand, I mean, there's a whole question of our involvement in Europe and so on. I mean, I personally don't see how we can ever not be part of it, but there are certain problems with the subsidies. But as long as we are going to want, politicians are going to demand cheap food. I mean, it's ridiculous that you can go into Tesco and buy 4 pints of milk for a pound.
It is.
It's obscene.
Well, people are selling milk for less than it costs to make it, aren't they?
The wool off the back of these sheep, you know, is the price they're getting for the wool is not covering the cost of cutting them.
Mm.
Well, what sort of stupid world is that? And yet you go and try to buy yourself a woolen jumper or a woolen carpet, we wouldn't afford it. I certainly couldn't afford it. No, if you could find anybody doing it.
Yeah.
You know, it's... I don't know what the answer is, but the tradition, you know, we need to decide what do we mean by tradition. Traditional landscapes, to me, is a nonsense. I mean, if I had a choice to go back, I want to go back to 1640, not 1840.
Mm, what would we have seen in 1640?
Well, 1640, you and I would have been sitting here chewing grass, probably.
Mm-hmm.
We'd have had a couple of cows down there. The oxen would have been in a yoke. You know, we'd have had a cart and we'd have been perfectly happy, probably.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we wouldn't. We'd,
more trees?
Would have fallen out. I don't know about that. That's an interesting one about the trees. I mean, certainly the uplands would have gone by then, wouldn't they?
Yeah.
I mean, you imagine these, you know, take these lakes out of the scenario. I would love to have seen these valleys. But, of course, they were totally impregnable. I mean, you look at the steepness of that slope and you consider those woods, this side and that side, going down. That's why the farms are all where they are. They've got to be up.
Yeah.
So I don't know that we would have seen more trees. We certainly would have seen more trees probably in the valley areas of Wales.
Mm-hmm.
Whether in the champion regions of England there would have been more trees,
I
don't
know. A long time ago it would have all been trees, wouldn't it?
Well, yes, but then you are going, you know, you're going back certainly Bronze Age. You know? I mean, I suspect by the Iron Age there was a lot that had been cleared.
Yeah.
And the climate changed then. I mean, certainly the fact that the peat arrived implies that the coverage had gone. And I think what we've got to realise is that the uplands, they weren't like these massive hanging sessile oak woods. I mean, it was dispersed Scots pine, birch and so on.
Mm-hmm.
Excellent wood pasture, really,
where
you could graze cattle through it.
Underneath it. Yeah,
underneath it, you know, which is a thing we've lost. And these hills are full of signs of that, you know, where the banks and ditches that run over these hills, they are telling you, look, this was farmed with cattle. There's one beautiful one up behind us here, quite fascinating, that I was looking at earlier in the week, having been put onto it by Brian Lawrence in Rheda there.
Did they use the bank and ditches to...
Bank and ditch, you see, absolute simple way of keeping cattle.
Yeah.
As long as you've got a ditch about 3 foot wide, 2 foot six, 3 foot deep, use the soil, put a little bank the other side, cattle, they can't do anything. The ditch is, you know, they can't quite jump it.
Right.
They put their feet down in it. They can't get out.
Right, okay.
So if ever you see a bank and ditch,
yeah,
the side of the ditch is where the cattle was. Normally the open, you know, and the in-by is usually on the inside.
Yeah.
And the bank and ditch is basically keeping stock out.
Mm.
So if you look over these hills, you can pick out where things were grown. Some of them would be, you know, delineating land boundaries. But, I mean, you look where we are now. Look at the Bronze Age cairns up there. There's a fabulous one just in front of us there, you see. So, you know, there was a heavily peopled landscape.
Yeah.
So the trees must have on the uplands. I mean, admittedly, the climate was slightly better than we're having now. But these would have been impregnable. I mean, you look at that wood over there. You couldn't do anything in there, could you?
No.
And if you followed that down to the valley bottom, you know, it would have been very difficult. But, I mean, I, you know, I, did a lot of work with Coy Cymru back in the sort of 80s, trying to get people to use the, or, you know, look after their woodlands. And to a certain extent, that's been achieved. But what hasn't been achieved is the wood being used.
Mm. Which actually is part of looking after the woodland, isn't it?
It is.
I was really surprised. We were a few years back, we were down in South Wales and we saw coppiced oak. I never knew we coppiced oak. And they're beautiful kind of snaky trees. And, of course, at Penlanoli we've got old coppice lime. There's a coppice beech there as well. Wood timber, it seems to me, most of it seems to perform really well when it's
coppiced. Oh, it does. I mean, even beech will you know, you see some of those. But, you know, unless somebody wants the timber, you can't keep getting money from a pot to give to people to look after woodland. It has to be self-sustaining, doesn't it?
People do want the timber, don't they? But the thing is, we're getting it really cheap from somewhere else, and I can't see how the price can in any way reflect the work and the transport.
No. Well, it's exactly the same problem with cotton, with food. You know, someone else is getting ripped off so we can get it cheap.
Yes.
You know, you ought not to be able to go into the builders' merchants in Rheda and buy any timber that didn't come from within 50 miles of here.
No.
And there's no reason why. It's perfectly good for building.
Yeah.
You know, look at the whole thing about, oh, I got an oak floor, oh, I got a lovely oak door. Well, for God's sake, you know, go and cut a tree and cut it. Yeah. But again, it's technology, you see. Mm. You go and take a piece of sessile oak to a modern sawmill and you laugh at you, they ain't going to saw that up. The computers can't handle a bend or a shake, you know.
Mm.
Ash the same. Who the hell's going to work on ash for you?
Mm.
And yet you go and buy a fitted kitchen that's made of ash or sycamore, you pay through the nose.
Yeah.
I can never understand it.
I remember reading a book called The Old Wheelwright Shop, which was...
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Do you remember that?
I've got it at home.
Fantastic, because they were saying how they would sometimes crop... Because he made not only wheels, but carriages.
Oh, yeah. Well, he made mouse traps.
Yeah. Yeah, and they'd go through
all
the woods looking at the trees and working out which trees were going to be which bit, and some of them had to be cropped like 8 years before you wanted them, and they were all stored differently, and absolutely fabulous book. And all of those skills, and I think you'd have got things that really lasted as well.
Well, the other thing you see that we've lost is what's called The Art of Timing. In fact, it's a very good book called The Art of Timing. We have been seduced into or driven into thinking, oh, yeah, well, of course, all timber is cut in the winter. Well, all timber isn't cut in the winter. For instance, if you look at an oak beam on an old house, right, if you don't want a piece of oak to catch fire, you're supposed to cut it on the first full moon after March the 21st or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
There's a set date. I know with tool handles, I used to have terrible trouble, cut my own ash tool handles. A damn worm would have been through it in 2 years.
Mm.
An old boy said to me, when are you cutting your ash? I said, well, you know, December. No, he said, cut it in June. Cut it in June, he said, just before the leaf has come full. You'll never get a worm in it. There's an old boy in the hills above me. His pot crane, you know the old pot crane in the fireplace?
Yeah.
Swings out, normally cast iron.
Yeah.
Here's his oak.
Right.
Oak never catches fire. It's there in the flames.
And that's because it was cut when it was wet.
Right, eh?
Cut when it was wet.
See, but we've got, all timber is cut in the winter. Well, it's not. Mm. And, of course, what then happens, worm gets into it, and people say, oh, listen, our timber's no good because the worm gets... Yeah, we'll cut it at the down right time.
Mm.
And you can work it better with a bit of sap in it. You talk to hedgers, you know. The bird lobby is, you know, along with the National Trust, is one of the most successful lobbying groups we've got. And they have persuaded the policymakers that we mustn't do anything with hedgers now until after, you
July,
know...
July.
We can't start... hedge until, 1st November, and we've got to stop by the end of March because of the birds.
Mm.
Birds nesting. Hedgers will tell you they'd like to go on really into early May. That's the best time, certainly through late April, May.
Mm.
And they will also tell you, because most hedgers I know are great nature lovers, bird lovers, that, yeah, okay, the stretch you're doing, there won't be nests this year, but down the way next year there'll be a whole load of nests.
That's the thing, a healthy hedge is good for the birds. That's...
But you see, we must... It's like ragwort. You know, the other great lobbying body in this country are the horse people.
Mm.
And they have persuaded everyone, oh, God, ragwort, we've got to get, you know, you get fined if you've got ragwort. Mm. It's only damned horses that suffer from it. The rest of the world doesn't suffer. Mm. Teach your horse not to eat the damn stuff.
Yeah.
Oh, it's on the roadside verge. Oh, my horse will eat it. Well, don't, you know.
Yeah.
The tail wags the dog very often.
Yeah. Well, it seems to me that
that everybody now does things for subsidies rather than doing something that works.
Yeah.
And from what you're saying, it sounds like a lot of the things that are being subsidised just don't work.
They don't work. They're not thought through. Mm. And to go back to what I was saying earlier about these early schemes where, like the Haymeadow reversion, no one then ever came out and checked whether it had worked.
Mm.
No one came out, you know, one of the things was, if you've got a lot of wheat ears, it's a sign of overgrazing. So we changed the grazing rate. No one ever came and counted the wheat ears. No one came back to the farmer and said, how many bales do you have for this field this year? And every year, how many have you got? You know, no one ever did that. So all those ideas that formulated that early agri-environment scheme, we don't know if it worked or not.
No.
You know, there isn't any evidence.
And the people who came to put the subsidies in didn't do any research or talk to anybody about...
Well, they had some ideas, either. You see. They thought, oh, well, of course, there's too much nitrate. So, like, one of the big problems at the moment is that, for whatever reason, which goes totally against traditional farming, you're not allowed to put any manure or artificial fertiliser onto what's now classed as a hay meadow. Well, the species diversity is narrowing and narrowing and narrowing. Mm. Like, where you are, you know, you can't not put manure on. You can't keep taking off the field.
No.
You know, you've got to put something back into the soil. It's the soil is the problem, you know, is what you've got to...
And the thing is, your soil's your primary crop, isn't it? And manure is different from spreading nitrates.
Yeah, quite.
The problem is that the land has become very nitrate rich because that's what's been put on it, whereas actually putting manure on it keeps it in nice balance. And in fact, when I heard that Ray Woods said that actually, a proper hay meadow, the plants are in community, the ancient hay meadows, the plants are all in communication with each other, and they know how much space is required, they somehow sort it out amongst themselves. But of course, they've got to have enough light and food to do that.
Because you don't see clumps, you know, it's dispersed. I mean, that's what it's about. Like, but, I mean, I know I was involved with it with a hay meadow, the farm I was telling you about, Dunsany Bridge. That was one of the first triple SI hay meadows, and so it was heavily studied. And do you know, within 10 years, 60% of those species had gone.
Because they tried to preserve it?
They wouldn't allow cutting, you know, cut after a certain period, and no fertiliser. Mm. Within 10 years, they'd lost 60% of the diversity.
Well,
fortunately,
again,
we managed to get a lot of it back.
How can they possibly hope to maintain it by changing the way it's been looked at?
Well, that's right. And that's the big thing that makes me scream. I had a classic case with great crested newts. I came across this nest of great crested newts in a February period, a very wet period, and I had to finish this stretch of wall by, I think, about the 14th of March. And, of course, it's, for one thing, under the 84 Wildlife Act, you're not allowed to disturb them. So I went to the officer in Llandeilo and I said, look, can I have an extension? I didn't want to tell him because I knew what would have happened. No, got to be done. I said, oh, look, you know, it's terribly wet up there. And it was a corner, and there was just this wet... A real wet sort of cattle pond, really. Mm. You know, sometimes water, sometimes not. And there was a good dozen great crested newts in this nest in this wall. No, it's got to be done. So I said, right, I'm going to see your boss. So I went to see the boss and I said, right, look, I'll tell you, I said, but I didn't want to say, I got great crested newts in that wall and I don't want to disturb it. No, it's got to be done. I said, right, so you were telling me I got to break the law. It's got to be done. I said, no, I'm not going to do it. And anyway... Then the next thing, he obviously told the person, oh, my God, great crested newts, which is the great holy grail. And, oh, great. Well, what did they do? Oh, they fenced. Oh, you can't have cattle coming in here, they're going to kill them. Fenced it off. Do you know, within 2 years, there wasn't a newt there?
No, because, again, they changed the environment in which the newts were living. Yeah.
And I've saved them time and time again, these people. Do you not realise that the reason the land is like it is because of the way it's been managed? And you come out and lord it and want to freeze it.
Mm.
You know, oh no, we can't. Oh, you can't have sheep in here; that they spoil the orchids. Mm. But hang on, the orchids are there. You know, like at the back here, loads of orchids at the back of this year. I know people who would freak.
Yeah.
Oh my God, the sheep!
But the sheep are providing some of them. I mean, I know they don't like too much nutrient, but everything needs a bit.
No, but I mean, to me, if something is there, it likes it, whether it's bats or newts or dormice or whatever. You don't need to change.
Mm.
I mean, unfortunately, I've gotten to the point now where I don't report things. Because, I don't want to cause my... I mean, at the moment, I've come across dormice this last couple of months, you know, in fabulous places. Mm. And the great crested newts by the dozen. I'm not going to tell anybody.
Because they'll come and try and preserve
them. Well, I don't want to cause trouble for the farmer. And the things are perfectly happy. I mean, one lot of great crested newts Brittany and I came across them back last September. We were doing a wall. I mean, God, they were actually on the edge of a farmyard, and they were living in the effluent from the slurry pit. It was overflowing.
Were they really?
And they were there, happy as Larry.
Yeah.
Great colony of 16, I think we counted. Now, if I'd reported that, you know, oh, right, oh, you can't have that, you can't have this, you know. The same with the dormice.
Yeah.
You know, and there we are. Well, so the midges are starting to bite.
Yes, they are. Do we see, just quickly, do we see any of these government schemes, Welsh Assembly government schemes or European schemes or anything actually working?
Yeah, I mean, I don't want to be, I'm sounding terribly critical. They're better than nothing, aren't they? At least something is being done.
Yeah.
If only giving jobs to people like me. But, you know, it is putting money into the rural economy, and it is showing farmers, certainly, farmers' children's more important, children more importantly, you know, it's educating, because that's what's missed. The agricultural college is really, is what the finger should be pointed at, because the generation of farmers we got now, most of them went to agricultural college, and they were not teaching people, you know, that whole, it was all about productivity.
Yeah.
And so we shouldn't be, you know, hammering farmers, because I don't say they don't know any better. You know, God forgive them, for they don't know, they don't know what they do.
Yeah.
But I do see there is an absolute change in attitude. But until the markets change, you know, what can we do?
So from what you're saying, the farmers are slowly but surely waking up to what's going on. And actually, in terms of changing the market, I mean, Europe or not Europe, what we need to be doing is convincing local people to eat the stuff that's grown by the people they know. Which, again, is like you say, we need to be doing the little bits we can do.
Do what you
Because
can do.
They count, don't they? Yeah. They really count.
I mean, I was, you know, in my previous life in a really good paid job and so on, and I was sitting on these committees and we were looking at, you know, it was the McSharry time when, oh, God, the hill, Welsh hill flock is denigrating the land, da-da-da-da-da. And people from the various universities and national parks. And I thought, well, what can I do? And I thought, well, the only thing I can do is build walls. So that's what I decided I'd do. Yeah. I gave up my company car and my
So what were you doing before you started?
Well, I started life in economics.
Did you?
But I was working in community community development and then into cooperative development.
Yeah.
But with small food producers, goat producers and wool producers and so on.
Yeah.
But I'd always had an interest in walling. And I could do it. It was something I could do. And people go into some great sort of wonder of the universe, really. I ended up in a place, accidentally, which then gave me 10 years' work 5 miles from home because I was the only waller in the area. You know, and that's what I do.
Yeah.
You know, because I'm in a sense ashamed of myself, and also I'm not hanging guilt on myself. I've decided I think the planet is gone beyond. I do what I can do.
Yeah.
I can't burden everything. So I do what I can do. And what I can do is build walls, create habitat, preserve the landscape.
Yeah.
And in the 20 years I've been walling, I've built 22 kilometres of wall.
Yeah.
Plus loads of garden stuff and created habitat. So
yeah.
I've done what I can do. You know, and hopefully when I get...
You're protecting the habitat you come across by not telling people about it.
That's right.
Well, yeah. That's really great. Thank you very much. I was quite enthusiastic to talk to somebody who knows a bit about what's going on.
Well, yes, it's difficult to get enthusiastic sometimes.
Yeah, I'm afraid that...
I think you've got to look small, unfortunately. But, you know, I do think acting small... Mm. I mean, this is what Prince Charles has been saying for years, and people thought he's a nutcase. He's absolutely right, you know.
Yes.
You've got to look at what you can do in this area.
Yeah, yeah.
And I do think that there is an opportunity in areas like this to produce food that could be sold locally, notwithstanding health and safety and food regulations and the rest of it.
Apparently in Germany there's a whole load of people now who are starting to do just that. There was some legislation left lying around there, which means they can change the nature of the way the place is run by plebiscites or whatever. And they are now trying in certain areas to bring back the cooperative model and to ensure that local farmers have at least one outlet in their local town.
Yeah, yeah.
So if they want to, there's a place where local people can...
Well, I mean, our farmers' markets held out great hope, but they've been hijacked in a lot of places, unfortunately, by, you know, not local farmers, you know, which is a shame, really.
Yeah.
But then, you know, I think the farming community, to a great degree, is at fault there.
Yeah.
As I say, go and find me a vegetable garden on a farm. Go and find me a farmer who's got chickens.
Yeah.
You don't find many of those.
No, and they'd all have added to the kind of...
Absolutely.
..what you can swap.
Absolutely.
That was very good, Stuart. Thank you very much.
Have you finished recording now?
I was still going just there. There it goes. There we go.
There you go, Stuart Fry there. I really love talking to these old boys. He knows so much, and I think, you know, in passing, I didn't realise how many kind of solutions he was chucking at us there on the way by. I mean, there was he seemed to have something to say about all of the problems that he was presenting. I mean, he kicked off with the fact that, or we kicked off with the fact that nobody wants to use the timber, and that a lot of our timber is in considerable trouble. And it is odd that people don't want to use the timber, because we know that these kind of our laminated kit, all manner of things actually, if you want to buy something that's not IKEA, it is going to cost you an arm and a leg. And yet the wood's out there, and the removal of the wood is part of the maintenance of the woodland. We had a quick talk there about coppicing. I mean, we do a wee bit of cursory hazel coppicing, which isn't, you know, in the old days, they were coppicing lime and beech and oak. I've been really amazed by how productive trees can be. You know, when you chop one down, it doesn't have to be the end of the tree. If you do it at the right time and it's the right kind of tree, then what you end up with is two or three trees coming out of the stump where the one tree was that you knocked down. So that the lime tree that I talked about at Pendanoli at the Willow Theatre Organic Farm is amazing. It's got, I mean, it's very old indeed. I don't think anybody knows how old it is. But actually, what it's got now is probably 8, 10, 12 stems, each of which are kind of, oh, I don't know, say a foot, 18 inches across, to the point where you can actually get into the middle of them. They form kind of like a little horseshoe around where the original stump of the original tree would have been. But they kind of, if it's cut at the right time, they shoot up as feeble little stems, and then if they're left, they grow into bundles of whole trees instead of just one tree. And like you said there, we used to use ash for all manner of things. It's really workable. I mean, I haven't yet done a lot of green woodworking. It is something that I'd like to do more of. But in fact, I think I showed a photo of it at one stage on the show. We had an ash mallet making workshop, if you like, in the woods, where everybody that came along, grown-ups and children alike, all made their own kind of ash mallet. And it's very workable, very useful wood. The oak, again, I was astonished when we went down to that place in South Wales and saw medieval coppiced oak woodland. It was old, and it was full of bluebells and rabbits and things. It looked absolutely astonishing. And what there were was a similar thing. There were stumps where the original tree had been taken down, and then another tree had grown up to replace it. And, you know, we talked a bit about the old, we just talked in passing about a book called The Old Wheelwright Shop, which was again a real eye-opener to me, because it was a story written by a guy who'd inherited his father's business, I think, in the early 1800s or something like that. I could be wrong there. Could be wrong about a lot of things. But what they did was they had several areas of woodland, and they went wandering through them, and they identified the patches of woodland, the specific trees in the woodland that they were going to use for specific parts of the wagon, because they didn't just make the wheels, they made the wagons, and as Stuart was saying, they made small things like mousetraps as well, probably from the offcuts and things. But they used to find the bits for every bit of the wagon they needed, and some of these trees would have to be felled kind of 8 years before they were going to use them, and every bit of them would be stored for a given length of time, and they'd be stored in different ways depending on which bit of the wagon they were going to be used for. And so there was this kind of real skill, a real relationship with the woodland and with the trees in it. It was also pointed out in that book that when the Oxford colleges were built with their huge banqueting halls and things like that, I don't know whether you've ever seen them, some of them have got huge oak beams across these really, really big rooms. And at the point where they built the banqueting hall or dining room or whatever it is you want to call it, at that stage they planted the trees that were going to replace those beams when they finally went in the roof. what kind of vision is that, you know? And now, like he said, the modern machinery won't deal with anything other than a straight tree. There are machines that can be taken into woodlands to, I think they're called wood misers. They're basically a kind of huge saw on a bed that can be used in a woodland for converting a felled tree into 3x3 and 4x2 and planks and all the kind of building materials you need. They're quite expensive, and there doesn't, you know, you need to be able to fell the trees in the first place and then be able to lift them onto the wood miser. But it strikes me that it must be absolutely marvellous to have the skills to do that sort of thing, because you're not destroying the woodland by cutting the trees down. What you're doing is giving the woodland a bit of time, the ability to regenerate. What seems to be happening now is that the woods are mostly being knocked down to burn them in power stations. We have an increasing number of wood-burning power stations, which I don't know, but it seems to me to be pretty crazy, because it seems pretty obvious that you can burn trees faster than you can grow them. But, you know, hey, what do I know? We touched there also at the very beginning on the kind of diseases that are currently coming into our trees, into the larch, the pine, the ash, the oak, the plane trees, especially the oaks. They're having a real problem. The larch, I think I've noted before on the show that the hills in Cymru are being stripped of their larch trees, and typically in the past that would have been a cyclical thing. You'd have seen a large chunk of them go down and be replaced, but there'd be a chunk either side left standing up. But each time I drive through a bit of Wales that I haven't been through for a while, I see whole hillsides that have gone. But then when you look at the hillsides where the larch are still standing, many of them are either sick or dead. So presumably they're being removed for that reason. I know that Synchro is currently in communication with the Forestry Commission, who are an interesting bunch in themselves, about the sudden ash dieback. It's something I've mentioned a couple of times on the show, and we're actively pursuing that. And she's actually had quite an informed and detailed response from them as to exactly what it is, what the Forestry Commission wishes to tell us about what's going on with the trees here. And they're telling us that there is only, for example, there is only one case of this rapid ash dieback, which is killing ash trees all over Europe. We did touch on it with Stuart there. But they're saying that there's only one case recorded in Wales, which is pretty strange, because if you actually go and look at their map, then last November there's little dots of it all over England, Scotland and Wales. So we're obviously going to pursue that. I'm also hoping to talk to somebody who runs a tree nursery, maybe a tree surgeon, try and find somebody who's got a little bit more first-hand knowledge of exactly what it is that's happening. But one of the things that's that we know is true, I see little oak seedlings all over the place in the various gardens that I work in. Wherever there's an oak tree to hand, there tend to be baby oak trees. But for reasons that are not entirely clear, in our ancient oak woodlands, like the one where I spend a lot of my time, the oaks are no longer seeding into the ancient oak woodland. It's like they know the time's come to move on. So a lot of the standard oak woodland that's left, and there isn't a lot of it, is oak and ash woodland, and they are changing. And they've been changing since, apparently, they call it the oak change, when this thing happened, when they stopped seeding into the ancient woodland. It happened about the same time as the grey squirrel came in. I don't know whether that's just a coincidence or whether it's something to do with the squirrels, but it doesn't really matter. What it means is that the ancient oak woodland is changing, and to actually be providing money simply to try and conserve something which is actually changing itself seems to be pretty crazy, but not as crazy as some of the other things that Stuart was really talking about. I mean, he mentioned that a lot of the planning is done by people who've been brought up through maybe a public school education and through the top universities and stuff, and then these people have an idea as to what the countryside should be like, that's based entirely on education and not at all on any kind of experience at all. And as we've noted before, it's extremely difficult for people who do have experience to actually gain access to the land or the woods to manage them the way they need to be managed. And for example, all of the money that's going into conservation and stuff is going into keeping people out of woodlands rather than actually using them as they need to be used. None of it, as far as I can see, is going into managing the hedgerows, which are one of the most prolific and fertile areas in the countryside. If they were actually being looked after and managed properly, then they would be the homes to many creatures, insects, birds, rodents, all manner of things. I mean, you should see the number of rodents that actually exist in the ancient woodland that we're lucky enough to get to spend a bit of our time in it. But it means that people who are doing the planning, people who are sorting out where the money goes, don't actually have any experience. They have an idea of what it should look like. Like Stuart says, there's this idea that the place needs to be kept looking tidy, which is overwhelmingly my impression of the land that I see around me as I drive or walk around. It's one of the reasons why I really like Old Chapel Farm and also the Plotgate place that we went to in Glastonbury, because they are trying to bring back the old management methods, which will be much more useful to the critters with whom we share this beautiful place. I mean, the talk about subsidies and grants and an endless, really, even in the relatively short time, the 15-20 years that I've been in Wales, there the endless stream of different schemes there have been here to try to encourage proper management of the land. For a start off, if they were a good idea and they worked properly, then perhaps we'd stay with the same scheme for maybe 25, 30, 40, 50 years, which is the kind of longevity that I think you really need to be talking to if you're actually going to achieve any kind of change with these sort of things. But as it is, you heard him say that, you know, they come up with the idea, they send out all the paperwork, people apply for the grant and stuff, and it's generally, you know, you've got to spend a given amount of your money before we'll give you any of our money, or debt tokens, or gaming tokens, or whatever we want to talk them, because of course we know there is no money, actually. And then, 6 months down the line, nobody's managed to come up with the cash. You've spent your 28 grand or whatever, you can't afford to take it any further forwards, and effectively it appears to be a scheme to get people to spend their own hard-earned resources in an attempt to get other resources which then don't turn up, which I mean, for a start off, it'd be really useful if people noticed that that's what was happening. The so-called UK government is being fined hundreds of millions of pounds by the European so-called government for failing to come up with grants, failing to distribute them properly, and don't seem to have learned anything about this at all. So a lot of farmers want to see their hedgerows included as set aside, which is, I guess, an interesting idea, but that's finally been accepted, which means that now, apparently, government departments are going to start measuring all the hedgerows, and the hedgerows are going to have to be measured before the grants and subsidies can be put into place, which is obviously going to result in several more hundred millions pounds worth of fine, I would have thought, for failing to come up with subsidies. It's just like we're banging our head against the same wall again and again. I think there is now a swing, certainly here, certainly in Cymru, back towards real farming. It may be that as the younger generation come up, we get to see a greater interest in, you know, older styles of sheep, in rebuilding the dry stone walls. That was fantastic, the bit about maintaining cattle by having a bit of a bank and a bit of a ditch, because the cow basically can't can't jump over it. So lots and lots of the of things that are needed now to keep cows in were just managed by shaping the very land itself. Paying farmers to make hedges, you know, I suppose the trouble is that you need now the stock-proof hedging, the stock-proof fencing either side of it, because the stocks are roaming pretty much wild over the hills. But it's a funny thing to think that farmers do not know how to plant a hedge and do the minimal amount of maintenance that's necessary to allow it to turn actually into a hedge. I mean, in truth, I guess when you look at it, it's not just the vegetation that grows up around it. There's rabbits, there's all manner of things that are going to come and have a go at any hedge you do try to plant. But it's one of my favourite activities, is getting bare root plants, which are basically pretty reasonably priced, although like everything else, they're getting to be out of reach now, and sticking in hundreds of them, because in 20, 30 years' time, you're going to have a real beautiful hedge, as I say, with all manner of things living in it. And then the business of actually handing out subsidies and for say doing a hedge, and then you come along 10 years later and find that the hedge isn't there, so you take all the subsidies back. Why have we ended up with a situation where this is how farming is maintained and funded? Because I gather that I think the majority, I'm not quite sure how much it is, I think it's something like 60 or 70% of the money that's actually made by your average farm is made as a result of subsidy. It's not made as a result of growing something and producing something that people want to buy off you. In fact, to the contrary, you know, the fleece from the sheep is now, to all intents and purposes, worthless. Your actual woolly jumper, made out of actual wool rather than synthetic yarns and stuff, is actually going to cost you an arm and a leg. How are those two things consistent with each other? And I wonder if we were working together, if people were working, as Stuart suggested they should, kind of with local people in the locale, producing high quality wool and then maybe trying to turn it into jumpers using people that you know and then marketing those and sharing the money from that. Given that so much of the grant money and subsidy money never actually makes it to the farmers for administrative reasons rather than through any fault of their own, perhaps that would be a good way to be looking at it. Perhaps it would be an interesting way to move forward. And I know that Stuart would like to see the food that's produced on farm sold locally and marketed locally, but then we'd have to overcome this fact that people seem to really love shopping in Tesco's for some reason or another, and it did seem time and again in that conversation that we were referring to the fact that as schemes were put in place to try and preserve something, the inevitable result of the said scheme was to end up in the removal of the thing from the landscape. So you the hay meadows, the idea that, oh well, we want to try and preserve this hay meadow, so it's had sheep dumping all over it for years and years and years, generations perhaps, and the result has been a really beautiful hay meadow with a really wide variety of plants and insects in it. So what we want to do is preserve that now, so you can't cut it when you used to cut it, and you can't let sheep manure it and things like that. And the result is that he said they lost 60% of the hay meadow within a very few years indeed. Now, it's not to say that these schemes are completely anathema to good practice, because there are many, many small farms that would not be surviving without these schemes, and there's also many of them that are making positive progress with the money they're getting, and they, because of the ludicrous prices for milk and wool and all that kind of stuff, it's very difficult for them to make the money any other way. But nonetheless, one of the things I think Stuart suggested, which sounded like a really great idea, was that instead of having administrators telling you that they want you to, this year we want you to have wooden fences, but wooden gates, but we want you to have them, you know, on the fields where people can see them. And then a few years later, a bit like the not learning the Welsh or learning the Welsh, they're saying, oh no, metal gates out there, we want you to have wooden gates on your farms. Just a complete lack of consistency. But if we were to have mentors, which I think if we're going to take this sort of idea up, it has to be really pretty soon, because it's clear that in a world where farmers don't keep chickens, where farmers don't have a vegetable garden just to keep the farmhouse going, where farmers don't know how to plant and maintain a hedge, we've clearly got to the point where a lot of our mentors are perhaps no longer available. And it would be really grand, I think, to see some of the things that Stuart was talking about preserved and carried on into the younger generation. I definitely get the feeling that there is a will there to learn about how to farm more sustainably. I don't like the sustainable word. I'd have to think of another one to use instead. But how to actually farm in a way that is a benefit to the creatures around you and a benefit to your own family, really. You know, what is the point in turning out thousands and thousands and thousands of acres of wheat and having no food on your own table from the farm? One of the things I really love about this place is that, I mean, obviously it never turn out stuff that you can actually sell, but at least it's feeding all of the people who come here for the time that they're here. And boy, do they get through some stuff, I can tell you. You don't half build up a bit, you don't half build up an appetite doing this kind of stuff every day. So I'm going to put on some more tunes because I need a breath of fresh air and a quick trip downstairs. I'd really like to find more people like Stuart to talk to. Also, my apologies for the low volume on some of these interviews. It's because they happen outside and the voice recorder I use, or indeed more or less any microphone that doesn't cost you an arm and a leg, is going to be affected by wind and by other things that are happening out there in the real world. And as a result, we're not sitting as close to the microphone as, say, as I am to this one. I'm barely a couple of inches away from this microphone. And that's really where we need to be to get the original volume. I do spend a fair bit of time processing them once I've got them, and they are a lot louder by the time I finish with them than when they're originally recorded. But it looks to me like we might have found a fairly simple software solution to that. All I need is a bit of education, and hopefully in future you won't all have to don your headphones or turn your volume up. But for those of you who did turn the volume up for the interview, be prepared for the fact that Georgia satellites are about to come at you with battleship chains, and you might actually want to turn it down a little. I'll be back with you in a few minutes. The John Preston tribute band there, and Not For Me, another of those Fire In The Mountain bands. I think he writes a really smart lyric myself. Before that, ZZ Top, Cheap Sunglasses. Thanks very much, Jill, for coming up with the word resilience when I was grappling with the word sustainable. The trouble is that so many of these words have been purloined, have they not? There's nothing actually wrong with the word sustainable. It's just that it's become attached to all sorts of things that I find wholly undesirable around me. In fact, I guess when we're thinking about the coppicing of trees, when we're thinking about the fact that if you go in and chop down an ash tree, you can end up with four or five ash trees that will, in a few years' time, be equally usable. Well, that is a sustainable activity, and that's the way I like to use the word. Also, thanks to Eddie for reminding me about the subject of propagation, because that's another example of the extreme fruitfulness of the world that we live in. When farmers go and get bare root crops and stuff for making hedges and stuff, it's because they have whole loads of it to do in a hurry. But plant propagation is one of my favourite activities, and indeed one of Synchro's as well. And in fact, most of the things that you'll find in a hedgerow, things like your thorns and your field maples and your ash, lots and lots of it can be, as you actually trim last year's hedge, if you gather it all up and just dunk it in a sandbed, then the vast amount of it is going to become a new bush. That is really how generous and thorough the world is around us. There is, so preserving something, preserving things like hedges and making more of them really ought to be a piece of piss. It is actually a completely miraculous thing that as fast as people are providing money to preserve things, they are in fact ensuring, it seems to me, their inevitable destruction. There is absolutely no need for things to be this way. I'm firmly convinced of that, and hopefully we'll be able to pull ourselves out of the kind of nosedive that we're in. I noticed also that Jill mentioned the word permaculture, which is, I think, it's a really great word. It's also a really great system. which I'll just have a quick look at. I'm aware now that you probably noticed that my voice has gone a bit quieter. I'm aware that everybody's gone to sleep around here, so probably what I'll be doing shortly is resorting to music for the end of the show. Hopefully we're going to be able to find a way of broadcasting from here that doesn't involve me doing it amongst sleeping people, but in the meantime, at the moment, that's what's going on. Somebody, can't remember who, recommended a book called The Resilient Gardener by Carol Depp. I haven't read it, but it's a good title, and it was recommended by somebody in the People's Internet Radio chat room, so it must be well worth a look, I would have thought. In terms of resilience, the permaculture people really have come up with some great ideas. It's something that we will be looking at in the future on the show, because I've got a couple of, well, permaculture is very much what's going on here, but there's other places I know where they've taken over what was standard farmland, maybe 35, 40 acres of it, and they are actually using permacultural principles to start producing stuff on it. It will be really interesting to see how these things work out. My guess is they'll work really well. Somebody did come up with 12 permaculture principles. I can't remember who it was. I remember it was a guy called David Holmgren, and he came up with these in his book Permaculture: Principles and Pathways Beyond Sustainability. So there's another reason why we might be a bit suspicious of the word sustainability. We need to get beyond that, don't we? The world is fecund. The world is extremely generous. It produces loads and loads of stuff. It's actually quite difficult to stop it from producing loads and loads of stuff at some point. Just look at the way your garden grows when you leave it alone. And I think his basic principles are just really useful. Just the words themselves, right at the top of the list, is observe and interact. Now, we notice that the people who are producing the money and the schemes and the grants and all of that sort of stuff are not observing and interacting. They're simply taking their own idea of the world without any experience whatsoever and trying to lay it on other people. And it is quite true to say that many farms would not have survived without these environmental stewardship schemes. And Stuart was freely recognising that. He said it's probably better than nothing. At least somebody is trying to do something. Even if it has led to Stuart realising that actually his dormice and his greater crested newts and his hay meadows and all that kind of stuff are much safer if you don't let officialdom know where they are, because they're going to come along and they're going to try and preserve them, and in that very act the things will disappear. Catch and store energy. That's a really good one. You know, it's something that is quite difficult for us to do. You try catching and making energy out of water, and they want an extraction license out of you and all sorts of stuff like that. Well, you know, I'm happy with the contract as it stands. Thank you. Obtain a yield. What are we doing? Some of the yields are disappearing. You know, people get a lot of wool from sheep. That is a yield. For some reason, the yield is no longer worth any debt tokens. I think this is extremely interesting and probably quite a difficult thing to deal with. However, as I say, if your yield happens to be wool and jumpers are expensive, then find some way of turning the wool into jumpers, even if it means working with a few people on an energy exchange. You can swap this for that. Keeps you out of the tax bracket, all that kind of stuff. The thing is, I suspect we need to stop taking the benefits. We need to stop taking the subsidies. We need to be doing the things that get us working with other people and producing things that either we or they need. That would be a really good start. Obtain a yield. Don't chase the subsidy. He doesn't say don't chase the subsidy. He just says obtain a yield. Fair enough. Apply self-regulation and accept feedback. Another really good one. Why keep running on with something that clearly isn't working? Why not accept the feedback of the situation and then try to do something about it? Use and value renewable resources and services, like the woods we were talking about earlier, like the fact that you can chop a tree down and get another one back, like the fact that you can just grab fistfuls of stuff that you've cut off your hedge, stick them in the ground, and within a year you'll have a thing that's growing, within 2 years you'll have something that you can plant as part of a new hedge somewhere. Produce no waste, a real challenge nowadays. most of producing no waste seems to me to involve not buying the bloody stuff in the first place. Lots and lots and lots of stuff is actually compostable, and compost goes down to absolutely nothing. Even after all these years, I am amazed by how much stuff you can tip into a compost heap before it actually gets full. But scrunched up paper, cardboard, food waste, loads and loads of stuff. I reckon a considerable weight of the actual waste produced by a house could be composted. Apart, of course, from all the plastic that somehow seems to arrive with almost everything we buy. Some things are without doubt more packaging than they are product. And the question has to be, do we actually want the product if it's got that much packaging? Perhaps a more valid question would be, do we actually want to take the packaging home, or just the item itself? Design from patterns to details is number 7 on Mr. Holmgren's list. Very good one. Looking at how things work, looking at how nature works, looking at the patterns of things that are going on around us, and trying to deduce what sort of details, what sort of systems we might devise to take advantage of that. Integrate rather than segregate. Another great one, because what we see around us, segregation is one of the golden techniques, I suspect, being used by the world management team, driving us to the point where we're becoming alone, separated from each other, separated from the landscape in which we live, separated from our food supply, separated from the people from whom we choose to buy the stuff which is passing itself off as food. Integration is what we're after, rather than segregation. And we're tired, are we not, of analysis when what actually we want is synthesis. Use small and slow solutions, if nothing else, because these tend to be a lot cheaper than using big and quick solutions. I've spent a lot of my time since I escaped from the factory doing landscape gardening, going in for people who are reasonably wealthy, and some of whom are very wealthy, and what they want is the entire place changing as fast as we can do it. That's it. It's very expensive and only tolerably effective. The only reason you really get away with it is because the product is not intended to turn anything out. It's intended to be pretty, to impress the neighbours and impress your friends. It's not intended to actually turn out stuff of use to produce a yield and that kind of stuff. And these gardens also quite often turn out a whole load of waste because the guys aren't willing to compost it. Small and slow solutions, part of the observe and interact, which was the first of the principles. Use and value diversity. Another great thing. You know, there's people out there who are shooting magpies because they think the magpies are killing the small birds and all of that. But in fact, for a start off, I think there's been a fair amount of research. I'm told there's been a fair amount of research. Who knows nowadays? Which suggests that the number of small birds and stuff that survive in a given area don't change noticeably just because magpies have moved in. But they do change noticeably if what you do is take the top off your hedge at the wrong time of year so that you're producing a supermarket shelf for the corvids, all of the crows, basically, who, you know, they need to put egg and meat on the table just like anybody else. The wee birds know where to put themselves where they're safe. All we need to do is make sure they stay safe. And shooting magpies and other members of the crow family is, in my opinion, not a way of doing it. Use edges and value the marginal. I particularly like that one. I've spoken before about the fact that edges are huge, are places where the most biodiversity occurs. As one thing changes into another, be it grass into a path and a path into a hedge, all that kind of stuff, that is where you will find most things growing, living and thriving. And as for valuing the marginal, I think that's a bloody great idea, because that is really... the marginal is marginalised, and we really need to be including it. So in a way, you're valuing the marginal. It's part of the integrate rather than segregate. It's part of synthesis rather than analysis. And until we start doing that, we ain't going to start seeing any results. But as soon as we do start doing that, we're going to start seeing big results. That is my feeling. Creatively use and respond to change is the final of these permacultural principles. Creatively use and respond to change. I think there's a whole lot of us, and I was one of them for many years, who really resented change. But in the end, was always forced to take advantage of it. And I must admit that when I finally decided to jump, you know, or make the change, it always led to an improvement. There's a saying, isn't there, better the devil we know than the devil we don't. Well, if you're working for the devil, the best thing to do is get your ass out of there. Creatively use and respond to change. Very good, that one. So, as I say, I'm aware that people around me have gone to sleep, and I don't like I don't like sitting here talking when I know that everybody's kind of getting ready for another big day's work out there, producing food, chasing animals around the fields. In fact, I think tomorrow is probably going to be a day of going up to the eventual site of the Neolithic village here and doing a bit more spreading of shit on the roundhouse we've got up there. That'll be another lovely day up on the hill. Picnic in the woods afterwards, I would think, and then hopefully a couple of glasses of homemade wine as we chill in the shade of the non-existent pavilion. So basically that's going to be about it for this show. I should imagine that next week, I'm not really quite sure where I'm going to be next week, actually. I don't think I'm going to be here. I'll probably be somewhere else. Hopefully I'm going to be able to come up with a show of some sort. It is a lot harder to actually find the time to do all the Skype stuff and all the emailing that's necessary to chase up the guesties and all that sort of stuff. If anybody's got anybody that they think Dr. Rock might usefully have a conversation with, you've had 3 years of the style now, then do by all means put them in touch with me. I'm always willing to talk with anybody about almost anything. And of course we must bear in mind that in over 3 years of the show, I haven't received a single phone call or Skype call from anybody in the actual chat room or anything like that. It would be really great to hear from you and have a chat if there's anything you want to talk about. So perhaps we can do that at some stage in the future as well. Hopefully, like I say, I'll be with you next week. If for one reason or another that doesn't occur, we will be live from the Green Gathering the following Thursday. But in the meantime, thanks to People's Internet Radio for still letting me be on here and doing these things. Thanks to all of you out there listening, because I think it's really great that we're still all here, because there's been a lot of trials. We've been a lot of trials and tribulations in the history of People's Internet Radio / MSI / TNS, and here we are still doing the shit. Really great. And marvellous to see you out there. Still 31 people there, and it's not far off the witching hour. I really do appreciate it, folks. You're absolutely great. Thanks to the lot of you. I'm going to subject you to some more music. Here's Thin Lizzy and Don't Believe a Word.